Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is Sunday morning. This is the Wake-Up Call with Sean McCord. Thank you, Dan Gould, for sitting behind me and punching all the buttons. It is warm. It is bright outside, and amazingly quiet. It takes me normally during the school year. It can take me 15 to 20 minutes to get to the station from my house. It took me 10 this morning. I'd forgotten. You forget how much impact the students have when they're here, and someone who can speak eloquently, I'm sure, about what it means to have students at the University of Virginia is my very special guest, President Terry Sullivan. President Sullivan, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Sean.
Well, I know it's been a busy few weeks, and it's Memorial Day weekend, so I appreciate you taking a little time from your time off to come in and fighting a little bit of a cold.
I am, yes.
So I double appreciate the time that you're taking to come in and talk to us. You're going to be leaving us soon as president at the end of July, and we just want to take this moment to kind of look back on your time here at UVA, the journey that brought you here, and what it's meant for you and for the university to have you as president. You're the eighth president of the university, which is kind of amazing to me. I've worked at the university, let me see, this is coming up on 27 years. So I've known a quarter of the presidents.
Well, remember, there was no president until 1905.
Yeah, I know. Yes. I'm cheating. We're cheating a little bit because of the way Mr. Jefferson himself struck to the university.
That's right.
But still, it's quite a history. And when you came to UVA, unlike the other presidents, you didn't have a connection directly to the university or Virginia. So part of what I hear, what I want to hear is, what was it like coming to a place that is so steeped in tradition, and what were some of the early adjustments that you had to make?
Well, of course, Edwin Alderman also had no previous relationship with the university.
See, I didn't know that.
I'm not the only one.
You know many more things than I do.
Well, I was very conscious of the fact that there was an awful lot about Virginia I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true politically and in terms of tradition, in terms of the personnel I'd be working with. It was a pretty steep learning curve at the beginning, but it was well worth doing. I'm glad I did it. There were some misgivings. I had one alumnus who told me, "I don't believe a woman can run my university."
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Just said that to you to your face?
Yes, uh-huh, yeah.
Well, you showed him, didn't you?
Well, actually, he came up to me a couple of years later, and he said, "You know, I was wrong."
Good.
I thought it took some courage for him to admit that.
It did.
Yes.
Good. Good for him and good for you, but good for him.
I think that there were people who felt that the University of Virginia is so unique and so unusual that to understand it, you have to have been here as a student and maybe as a faculty member, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't have a connection to the university when we first moved here. My experience was all on the West Coast, and to come here to place so steeped in tradition and just the way things are done, just hiring the first woman president was not something that had been done before.
No, that's true. And as I've often told audiences, I couldn't have attended UVA out of high school.
That's right.
Because they didn't yet admit women into the first-year class. But my husband's family was from Virginia. My mother-in-law went to Mary Washington. You know, I had had some context for the Commonwealth itself, if not for UVA.
And do I remember correctly, did you still had school-age children when you came here?
No, my two children were already adults and out of the nest.
Okay.
And now married.
Oh, good. I was there in the dome room, the rotunda, when you were introduced to the university at large, you and your husband and your children, and it was a nice moment. And one of the things I've always appreciated about you is the fact that we could just run into each other, just out and about, which was less true with your predecessor. But I mean, I remember going to CVS and standing behind you in line at CVS and turning to my daughter and saying, "That's the president of the university in front of us, probably buying cold medicine."
It's been true lately, yes.
Yeah, and see you walking around the lawn on Halloween, handing out candy.
Yes,
and coming up to Cars Hill for the annual Christmas party, which is always fun. Do you find that as students? I mean, you've been here 8 years, so you've seen a couple of graduating classes. Do you find a difference in the way that the students have approached you from 8 years ago and they do now, with the level of comfort and familiarity?
Gee, I'm not sure I do, because every entering class, it's all new to them.
Right.
And so they're not really conscious that this could be precedent shattering in any way. And so you kind of have a fresh slate with every entering class that comes in.
Yeah.
And by the way, the class coming in this fall looks really, really special.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember seeing you speak in 2014, I guess it was, to the students who were graduating, who had been incoming freshmen when you were an incoming freshman.
Yes.
In 2010, and you know, I've been at the university long enough that I see those many generations. I mean, I know that there are students now whose parents were students.
Yes.
When I first started working at the university in the early 90s. So you came here from Michigan State.
No, the University of Michigan.
Excuse me. I'm so sorry. I bet that's something that drives you nuts when people get that wrong.
Well, I actually graduated from Michigan State.
There we go. Okay.
But then I was the provost at Michigan, and that in itself was precedent shattering.
Was it really?
Oh, yes. Well, imagine, to give you the analog, suppose we hired a Hokie here to be provost.
That would never happen.
I think there are a lot of people in Michigan who said that would never happen.
Yeah, all right. And you were provost there for how long?
For 4 years.
4 years. Now, in your academic career, did you suspect that you were going to get into college and university administration? How did that happen?
Well, when I was a senior at Michigan State, the president at that time was Clifton R. Wharton, and he started a program of presidential fellows, and I was asked to apply to it. And so I spent my final year at Michigan State as an intern in his office.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty influential on me. For one thing, I realized that although I had been very active as a student leader and thought I knew the university, I didn't know anything.
Yeah.
Until you're in the new position, you don't realize how much you don't know. So it taught me a certain level of humility about administrative positions. But Dr. Wharton said to me, you must go and get the union card, by which he meant the PhD. You have to go to graduate school. And I was very naive. I knew nothing about graduate school. I said, well, where should I go? And he said, well, I went to the University of Chicago.
Okay.
So I applied to the University of Chicago, and I was admitted there.
Well, when somebody tells you that gives you that kind of direction, it's a good idea to go that way.
Well, it was a very good school. It was ranked number one in my field at that time, so it was actually a really good choice.
Tell us about your field.
So I'm a sociologist, but my particular field in sociology is demography.
Mm-hmm.
That's off on the more quantitative scientific end of the field. Demographers study human populations. Demographers are the people who design and carry out the U.S. Census, for example.
Right.
So it's closely aligned with statistics on the one hand, but also with survey researchers on the other. And demographers have particularly done a lot of work in developing countries where there's not a good statistical system to try and suss out what's going on in terms of, say, birth rates. My own work has been in labor force demography, mm-hmm. so I've been interested principally in trends and patterns in unemployment and underemployment. And from that, actually, it was a short step to studying bankruptcy, which I subsequently did. It's a form of economic marginality. Although I did a little work in some other areas, such as immigration, demographers do a lot of work in immigration, I would say that labor force was my dominant area of interest.
And do I remember correctly that you co-authored or researched with Elizabeth Warren?
Yes, and also Jay Westbrook. Under Sullivan, Warren, and Westbrook, we published two books and a large number of law review articles. I don't recall at the moment how many.
Mm-hmm. And did that background help you, do you think, in university administration and ultimately being the president?
It was enormously helpful. For one thing, I became pretty comfortable reading a balance sheet. And actually, just knowing about indebtedness and how indebtedness works mm-hmm. is really very important, not just because the university itself makes use of debt strategically, say, when we're building a new building, such as the hospital wing, but also because we're concerned about limiting the amount of debt our students take on while they're still students. And I'm really happy that UVA has kept a cap on loans. Fewer of our students graduate with any debt, and of those who have debt, they have less debt than the national or the state average. That's a good thing, and I hope we can keep that.
You know, I've had like six or seven. I've honestly lost track of how many jobs I've had at the university. I'm one of those people who changes jobs every few years. Mm-hmm. So there's always that first day when your talent, your skill, your experience, your contacts has brought you in. You sit down at your desk and you have that moment of, now what am I supposed to do? But I've had, you know, I've had tiny little jobs compared to being the president of the university. When you came in with this deep background in university administration, having been a provost and statistics and analysis, was there something in those first few months of that first year? It's like, man, I wish I had known more about this.
Oh, without doubt. I mean, for one thing, the Commonwealth of Virginia is very different from other states in mm-hmm. its form of governmental organization. And it was clear that the legislature, although our appropriations are diminishing, had great influence on the university in other ways.
Right.
Learning about restructuring was very important. Restructuring was a policy passed by the legislature some years before I arrived, mm-hmm. which gave the university and a couple of other large institutions, such as Virginia Tech, what was called structured autonomy, which meant that we were able to take on for ourselves some functions that the state would otherwise be performing with us. And on the other hand, there were some functions the state reserved for itself. So learning which functions worked which way was an important part of starting the job.
Yeah.
I don't think I had anticipated how much time I would spend in Richmond.
But you get settled in. You get settled into and the Cars Hill. And those first few years, what were the immediate things that you looked at, and then you thought this is something that that I can work on, that can make an imprint.
Yardley Love had been murdered right before exams.
Yeah.
That spring, and the university had not had a chance to really grieve over it, talk about it with each other, because we were immediately in exams, and then after exams, students went home. So I was there that August when the students came back, and I realized, talking to students, they really needed a place, a chance to talk about this. Mm. So we had what was called the Day of Dialogue on a Friday in September, and it was just an opportunity for different members of the community to get together and talk about what they saw as the culture of UVA, what they thought could be improved. I think it was, for people who participated in it, a hopeful and healing conversation. One of the things that grew out of that was the Respect At program, which is a workplace respect program, because I heard from lots of our employees who felt that they were not being treated fairly by supervisors and others.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized we had a lot of work we could do there. But I think that that was helpful for recognizing and appropriately memorializing that this was really a devastating event in the life of the university.
Well, it's always devastating when a university loses a student.
Yes,
and it's happened every year, but especially since Yardley, we've had some really high profile deaths.
Yes,
and these kids, and I feel comfortable calling them kids because I have college age. I know they're young adults, but my kids are college age, so I feel very paternal towards them. Man, some of these things, these classes, the past few years have had to deal with, and ultimately, everything kind of falls upward. And many good things as have happened the past few years. I'm sure there's a few tragedies that will stand out. And what are your thoughts on the students themselves and how they've we don't have to go through the litany of tragedies that we've gone through. We'll talk about some of them, but as a cadre of young adults, what are your impressions of UVA students as they've gone through some of these hard times?
Well, my overwhelming impression is that they're very resilient.
Yeah.
But they actually don't believe that they are.
Mm.
And they're often told by the media and others that they're snowflakes and
right.
They're not resilient and so on. But what we find is that when they're facing a huge challenge, they rise to the occasion. I saw this, say, after we lost Hannah Graham.
Yeah.
When microphones were thrust in the face of random students walking across the lawn. And they spoke articulately and clearly without hesitation in full paragraphs. And I'm sure if you'd asked them in advance, could you do that? They would say, oh, no, I wouldn't know how to do that. But they did do it. That's pretty impressive, I think.
Yeah.
And they are, by and large, a pretty impressive group.
And of course, there was a Rolling Stone article, and how that kind of ripped a whole lot of things apart, and then we had to go through the process of coming together and healing again. Because although there were some truths that were uncovered by that incident, it turned out that the whole thing itself was based on a falsehood. And seeing the kind of whiplash effect that had on everybody here in the university. We're going to take a break in just a moment, so maybe it's a little unfair for me to ask this with just a few seconds left. But what are your general thoughts about what we went through and how we came through that time?
Well, I think that we looked at it as an opportunity for leadership,
mm-hmm.
and in particular for an opportunity to look at the things in our culture and climate that weren't positive and try and change those. In some ways, it was like the Day of Dialogue back in September of 2010.
Yeah.
And we implemented, I think, some good changes. We implemented some changes in policy that I think have proven to work well. But the underlying problem, which is sexual misbehavior and sometimes predatory behavior, that's one that we have not conquered, but no workplace has. So I don't necessarily feel we are worse off than other institutions, but it's something that needs to be worked on all the time.
That's a good answer. My guess, and I'm supposed to announce this more often, is UVA President Teresa Sullivan. This is Sean McCord. You're listening to The Wake Up Call on WPVC. This is the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord with my guest, UVA President Teresa Sullivan. And I'm going to refer my listeners to a really useful article that came out a few weeks ago and is available online on UVA Today. That's news.virginia.edu. Just look for an article called The Sullivan Years. As I was researching this week about what to talk about, I came across this article, and it does by McGregor McGantz, who did a really remarkable job of kind of highlighting everything that's happened for the past 8 years. And let's move away from tragedy just talk a little bit more about the significant accomplishments that have happened in the past 8 years under your administration at the university, some of which I think have gotten a lot of public attention, others of which kind of seem in the weeds but are important. I'm talking about things like the Cornerstone Plan, the capital campaign, the strategic investment fund, things that are going to have a very significant difference on the way the university operates. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of those.
Well, I think an important one that I'm proud of is the reorganization of the health system.
Yes.
And what I think has been a remarkable attention there to improving the quality of patient care.
Mm-hmm.
And it's showing up in our metrics that we're doing better all the time, even though we're a very high acuity hospital, meaning we treat the sickest people. We treat people who have not just one condition, but they have multiple conditions. That makes it much harder to do. But I think we're doing a really excellent job. I'm very happy with the quality of new physicians we've been able to recruit. I'm very happy with the caliber of research that we're doing. We're really national leaders in a number of important fields. This is all very important to the future of the university. People don't realize that UVA's half medical. Half of our faculty and half of our revenues come from the health system.
Yeah, and I've worked on both sides. And that's often how we refer to it down here in the trenches, the sides of the university. There's the academic side and there's the health system side. And I know in my early years, especially transitioning from one to the other, it always felt like there was a schism. I don't mean a conflict. I mean just the way things are done. You know, you could be a lifetime employee at the university, and unless you've had a medical condition, not have any relationship with the health system side, and vice versa. So, what is just for clarification, what is the president's office relation to the university health system?
Well, the university president is actually responsible for three state agencies.
Mm-hmm.
We refer to one as the academic division.
Right.
That's what most people think of as the University of Virginia. The second one is the health system, and the third is our college at Wise.
Right.
Located down in Wise, Virginia. So all three of those are important, and I have to pay attention to all three. The health system is a little bit different in that it is dispersing beyond Charlottesville at a pretty rapid rate. We do a lot of telemedicine,
mm-hmm.
particularly in Southwest Virginia. We have relationships with Novant hospitals going north along 29. And we have a new research and educational relationship with Inova Healthcare, particularly Fairfax Hospital. So we'll begin having medical students doing their third and fourth year up in Fairfax. We have a lot of medical students from Northern Virginia. They're pretty happy about that.
Yeah, yeah. When you came here to the University of Virginia, had your prior experience as provost, was this all new to you, having to work with a hospital like UVA's?
No, Michigan has a very large health system. And Michigan actually has five health-related schools because besides having medicine and nursing, which we have, they also had pharmacy, dentistry, and public health.
Okay.
So it was a big part of the portfolio. And, of course, the issues healthcare faces are in many ways similar across the country.
Sure.
And so I had an opportunity to become familiar with those issues before I got here. I don't think I would have been nearly as effective in the job had I not had that experience.
Another hallmark of Virginia that's different from other parts of the country is our sense of history, not just the age of the university and our founder,
mm-hmm.
But that Virginia, and in particular this part of Virginia, is deeply steeped in American history, in Civil War history, in the history of race in America. And one of the commissions that you started was the President's Commission on Slavery. How did that come about? At what point in your time here at the university did you realize that this is something that ought to be addressed and could be addressed out of the president's office?
Well, when I came to the university, I was really conscious that we had a bicentennial coming up,
mm-hmm.
and that we needed to plan for it. And as I listened to people, I heard the voices of particularly African-American students who were already petitioning to have a memorial to enslaved laborers. And I asked the question, who are these enslaved laborers? And actually, we didn't know very much.
That's right.
That history was pretty much hidden. And I decided we could not have a meaningful celebration of the bicentennial without really knowing what was in the background, what was the history. So this commission, which worked for 5 years, did really significant work for us. They uncovered the names of hundreds of enslaved people who had worked at the university, not necessarily owned by the university. The university owned a couple of people,
yeah,
but they were often rented from local landowners instead. But basically enslaved labor built the rotunda, much of the academical village. Not everyone was enslaved. There were also free workers who worked on it. But there's no question that there was a significant enslaved population there. So among other things, we discovered an unmarked, really unknown cemetery of enslaved people, which we have now appropriately memorialized. We have signage so people understand what it is. Fortunately, we still don't know the names of the people there, but at least we've reconstructed a bit of that history. We've named two new buildings for people who were enslaved and worked at the university. One is Gibbons House, which is the residence hall located directly across from Scott Stadium. And it is named for a couple. Isabella Gibbons, after emancipation, became a teacher at the Jefferson Free School. And her husband became a local minister. And after her death, he eventually moved to Washington, D.C., was a very famous minister there. So we felt naming this house for these people who had served the university both in bondage and in freedom was an important sign. The other building we've named is Skipwith Hall, which was named for Peyton Skipwith.
Yeah, it's a great name.
It is a great name, yes. He was one of the masons who helped build the rotunda. But he was later freed by his owner, and his owner paid for his passage to Liberia along with his children. But he wrote letters back to his former master, which was interesting because it was illegal to teach slaves to read and write.
Right.
Yeah. But he was obviously literate. And he wrote letters back to his master about conditions in Liberia. So that's how we knew his story. It turned out that his master, whose name was Cook, there's a building name for him on the lawn, left his papers to the university. And these letters from his former slave were discovered among his papers. So there were a lot of things involved in uncovering this history, but I think that it's told us a lot that we didn't know about the university going up to 1865.
And pardon me for not knowing this, where is Skipwith Hall?
Oh, so Skipwith Hall is located, I guess the closest way to describe it to you would be that it's almost adjacent to Zimmer Hall. It is located down a service road behind the St. Thomas Aquinas parking lot.
Okay, yeah.
And it's a new, very nice building that's inhabited mostly by our trades workers, who are the successors of Mr. Skipwith. Yeah,
that's very nice. Now, you mentioned the, before I get to that, I'm just curious, these buildings, Skipwith and Gibbons, in addition to being named after enslaved laborers, is there a little historical context? Is there a plaque or some kind of display explaining the names and who these people were?
There is. There's really a very nice display inside Gibbons House. And then we realized, uh-oh, you have to have a student ID to get in.
Oh, yeah.
So we've now put some signage outside the building as well. And there's similarly signage at Skipwith Hall there.
And you mentioned the memorial to enslaved laborers. This is something that I'm not sure a lot of people know is coming.
Yes, the board's approved the idea. They've approved the architectural drawings. And we hope to have a groundbreaking on that next year.
Next year, that soon?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Wow. Yeah. And that's going to be near the rotunda, within sight of the rotunda.
But it's also near the corner and in a spot that's close to the rest of Charlottesville. So it is down the slope from the rotunda, located just off Main Street in that grassy field there.
Yeah, yeah. So in addition, now, is the memorial a direct result of the commission, or were they parallel efforts?
No, they were not parallel. The The commission recommended the construction of the memorial, but the commission is not really responsible for it because, as I said, the students had already been petitioning for this before the commission was set up. So the idea really was born probably in multiple places.
So what do you think are the big accomplishments of the commission?
Well, one of the things they did was they founded an organization called University Studying Slavery, which now has membership from several continents. They've hosted two very important conferences, and there was also a conference co-sponsored with Monticello and with UNESCO about slavery in world context.
That's right.
The North Atlantic slave trade involved Europe and North America, but also South America and obviously Africa. And so universities in all these places are interested in beginning to look at their legacy in the North Atlantic slave trade. So Brown University was an early advocate of this approach. Mr. Brown made his money in the slave trade.
Right.
Yeah, so Brown University was very early to the study of slavery in its own past.
Well, and obviously our funder has a complicated relationship with slavery.
That's right.
And as does the university. So I think it's, you know, coming here from the West Coast, these were discussions that I wasn't used to having. So I think it's important that we've just in the time I've been here, that we've been more forthright and more willing to discuss some of the disturbing parts of our own past at the university and in Charlottesville.
So last week I also announced the members of a new commission.
Yes, I was just getting to that. Please,
yeah.
Tell me.
So this is a commission to study the university in the age of segregation, which I'm going to say approximately is 1865 to 1965, essentially it brackets emancipation up to the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And so a lot of things happen in that period of time, but again, our history there is not totally known.
Yeah.
And it's going to take some archival research and I think some oral histories to recover some of that. So, for example, the story of Greg Swanson, who was the first African-American student enrolled in the School of Law, that story had been more or less lost to us. He actually went to court to get the right to go to law school. This past spring, we dedicated a portrait of him that hangs now in the law school. And there's been a Swanson Prize established in the law school. So his name will be memorialized going forward. But that was a name that had been somewhat lost to us. Walter Ridley, another important name, was the first African-American PhD from the university. And we do have a set of scholarships named for him, which the Alumni Association administers.
And Swanson came to school in, what year was that? 19, I don't remember. It was in the 60s.
Yeah, I think that's right. It might even have been a little earlier than that.
Yeah. And the university, in the past few years, in the past 8 years under your administration, has definitely grown more diverse. We've increased both the number of students and the number of students from minority populations, from other countries. I don't quite know how to ask this. How did you approach that as president? How deliberate were those moves to try to open up the diversity of our students?
Well, I'm pretty proud of the fact that we have students from 49 states and 125 countries.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing, but
What's that one state? What's the 50th state that's not represented?
I think it's North Dakota.
Well, we got to work on that.
Yes, we do. I'm proud of the fact that a Virginia resident who comes to UVA is going to have the opportunity to work together with people from all these different backgrounds. And even if for some reason you aren't able to study abroad or maybe your parents can't afford to let you study abroad, you still get to meet people from other countries who can talk about how they grew up, what their hopes and dreams are. And I've seen this work. I had an advisee whose roommate was from Peru. And my advisee was from Northern Virginia. His parents invited the Peruvian roommate to come up for Thanksgiving just because they didn't want him to be alone in the residence hall at Thanksgiving. Well, the Peruvian parents were so grateful, they invited my student to come to Peru for 3 weeks in the summer. So
nice.
He went. He had a wonderful time. He loved Peru, and he changed his whole direction of study.
Wow.
He had been interested in commerce with Asia. He changed it to commerce with Latin America. And that probably wouldn't have happened had he not had the chance to get to know this young man from Peru.
And that is the beautiful thing about college. It's the opportunity to meet people from such diverse backgrounds, from different parts of the world, from, well, even from different parts of your own country, and mix and intermingle and learn things and have the direction of your life changed. You've spoken about this, about criticism of colleges and universities for on the right because we're trying to indoctrinate diversity, trying to expose people to liberal ideas, and I know that as president you also probably get a fair amount of criticism from people on the left about what the universities aren't doing. But as a, it's kind of an admixture of people and places and experiences and events. There's nothing quite like a university for molding, no, not molding, for opening up people to experiences outside of what they might've gotten in their hometowns.
Well, I think that's right, if you're open to it.
Yes.
Well, one of the issues we talk about with students is being open to it. And some of them are. Some of them look for the security of their classmates from high school to hang out with them.
Sure.
And we encourage them, don't do that.
Yeah.
Meet some other people. You know, you're always going to have your high school friends. Make new friends.
That was exactly my experience at my college. I was grateful that some people I went to high school, showed up there. Turns out we didn't have a whole lot in common. And other than occasionally running into them in the dining hall.
But as to indoctrinating students,
yeah,
that's not what we're about.
No, it's not. It's just opening up the world to experience. And in addition, one important population that we've been addressing is more students with financial need in the past 8 years. It is 11:39. We're ready to take a break. My guest is President Teresa Sullivan, President of the University of Virginia. This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I keep forgetting to introduce my guest with a distinctive voice. This is President Teresa Sullivan. Thank you again for being here. We are listening to the Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Fortune magazine, I'm going to give you another opportunity to reject this. Fortune magazine called you the unluckiest president just because of the series of events that happened your first few years here, and you have roundly rejected that label. But you certainly have been president during interesting times at the university. Everything from high-profile deaths of students to your resignation and then reinstatement and culminating, well, hopefully the worst of it was the Unite the Right rally and the invasion of the university. Last August. Let's talk a little bit about that one, because that's still, Charlottesville is still reeling from that. Charlottesville and the university are still reeling from the events of last August. And I've lived here 27 years. I've really felt that the town has changed, that people are In many ways, I think good ways, are now talking about things that we were hesitant to talk about before. Some of the history of racism and nationalism that this town was built on, but I think also still just a lot of PTSD, a lot of traumatic stress. So we've got an anniversary coming up. And you're not going to be president at that time, but can you talk about what changes, what policies have been put in place, and what things the university might be able to do to prevent some of the kind of events that happened on August 12th?
Sure. Well, we were, of course, most involved August 11th.
Yes, of course. August 11th was the night of the torch-lit rally on the lawn.
Right. And, you know, what I would say about August 12th was our health system responded magnificently.
They did.
But August 11th was, you know, certainly very difficult, in part because we didn't really know what we were dealing with.
Yeah.
You know, and in retrospect, you know, that 2020 hindsight.
Right.
We can see things that we should have done differently. We did an assessment within the first 30 days and came out with it and had a number of issues identified that we needed to work on, and we have systematically worked our way through them. And one of them was changing our policy around open flames. One of them was defining the academical village as a place where guns were not permitted. I know it's kind of surprising, but we hadn't defined it as a facility, and so you could carry guns there. Also requiring now notice in advance of people who are not a part of the university, who plan to be there for any kind of expressive activity. We're not judging the content of that activity. It's content neutral. But we need to have warning that you're coming, in part because we're expected to provide security in that case, and we don't know where to deploy the people if we don't know who's going to be on our grounds. So I realize that that new policy has created a bit of controversy.
Well, it's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
I mean, you know, we're talking about policies that brush up against the First and Second Amendment of the Constitution.
Absolutely. You know, I will say that none of this affects people affiliated with the university, students or employees.
Mm-hmm.
They can still do anything anywhere, basically, without notice. But it does affect people who aren't affiliated with us, such as the people who came August 11th.
Right.
So that our police would at least know that you're coming and where you're going to be and have a contact person to get in touch with. All things that didn't work very well, didn't work at all, actually, August 11th. Now, for people who still wish to deliberately deceive us, this won't be enough.
Right.
It's like the military preparing for the last war. So we have to be a little more flexible and agile in thinking about how we would deal with these things in the future. But in terms of the technical First Amendment and Second Amendment issues, a policy similar to ours has withstood review at the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. That policy came from Maryland, and our policy was closely modeled on theirs, heavily drafted. You know, much of the work was done by our law faculty, who devoted a lot of time and effort to this. And then we also sent it out for review by student government, by the staff senate, by the faculty senate. We had all of these bodies have a chance to have a look at it and give us their feedback about it before we put it into effect. So I'm sure nobody thinks it's perfect. That's why there's a requirement that we review it every year, July 1st, to see how it's working.
And I don't, you know, this actually, that's news to me. I was following the story and I didn't know about the review.
Yes, that's right.
So, and I think it is important for people to understand that this wasn't, these aren't just capricious policies.
No.
That you study and see what has worked elsewhere. It is tricky, especially when we're talking about First Amendment issues. You know that there was a in response to that, there was a UVA alum who then, I think, mounted the steps, informed the police ahead of time, but then mounted the steps of the rotunda and was reading passages from the Bible in defiance of that policy.
Yes.
So how do we and I want to give you credit, President Teresa Sullivan. You didn't bring the university lawyer with you here to parse your answers. But how do we kind of thread that needle between issues of the First Amendment with wanting to guarantee free speech and wanting to not have the kind of not kind of have the out of control events that happened on August 11th?
Well, the first thing is that we're a state agency.
Yes.
And so we are bound by the First Amendment in a way that private institutions are not. So Liberty University, for example, has much more freedom to regulate people who come to their campus than we do.
It's a private university.
That's right. Secondly, this didn't have anything to do with the gentleman reading the Bible. It would have been the same if he'd been reading the Communist Manifesto or if he'd been reading the Google Terms and Conditions of Privacy. It doesn't matter. Yes. It was during exam week. There are students who are living and working there in the academical village. The academical village is just not a place where we allow non-participants to do free speech. The police escorted this man to the nearby sidewalk. The sidewalk is public.
Mm-hmm.
He can do anything on the sidewalk, mm-hmm. and he did. So I don't think that this was terribly confining of his free speech rights. But, of course, it did set up the headline, the University of Virginia bans Bible reading, right? Which is, you know, the most extreme reading of what actually happened.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, you live in a, you live and work in a public place. We're going to get those kind of public fights. So just to hit a few more points. What has the university, what new policies are in place in response to August 11th that we feel can help mitigate a similar event in the future?
Well, for starters, you can't carry a tiki torch unless it's been approved in advance.
And that has to do with the open flame
policy. That's right. That's right. You can't bring weapons on the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
You have to notify the police at least a week in advance of where it is you want to be. And there are 9 available locations, which are public and well-traveled, where you can be. You can pick any one of them. But then the police know where you're going to be and what time and so on. But the time, place, and manner policy also specifies that this is limited to weekdays and daylight hours.
Right.
And the reason for that is so that we have sufficient personnel around to provide security and safety. The Friday night before students even showed up for classes was not a very good time for us to have a lot of people that are able to handle an event.
Yeah. And what are the firearm restrictions now?
So no one who is an employee or a student at the university can possess a weapon on the grounds. But citizens of actually Virginia or any state can carry weapons in outdoor areas that are not otherwise regulated. So what's regulated are facilities like our buildings, events such as graduation and sporting events.
Right.
So there are some common sense rules about where you can and you cannot have weapons. You know, the emergency room of the hospital comes to mind.
Right.
You know, it's not a place that we want to have people coming in with weapons. Tensions are already high. There's a lot of emotion there, a lot of pain and suffering. We don't want somebody armed walking in there and ginning that all up again.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry to go on about that, but I just feel like it's important for people to get a sense of what's changed since August 11th.
You know, besides that, I think that we've done some other things that are very helpful in terms of increasing scholarship money available mm-hmm. to low-income students. We've changed some of the memorialization around the rotunda. I think we've done a lot of things, some of which may be seen as more symbolic, to indicate that we want to be an inclusive community, welcoming to everybody from every background.
So, what are you going to miss the most?
Well, final exercises is really just remarkable weekend. I think I will miss the excitement and really thrill of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an awful lot of fun. And, of course, we just had it. The next 2 weekends coming up are reunion weekends, and those are also just a whole lot of fun. Our alumni are very devoted. They come back in large numbers, and it's great to see them. So those are the kinds of events I think I'll miss. While I'm on my research leave, I'm certainly going to miss UVA basketball and also other sporting events.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. You're going to Texas on your research leave.
Yes, that's right. So we're going to Austin, Texas. Our 2 sons live there.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I are both emeriti faculty at Texas. But it's also currently ranked number 1 in my field, so it's a great place for me to get myself back up to speed on what's happening in demography. And they've offered me the opportunity to audit, to have an office, and so on. So it's a good location for us for a little bit of time before I come back and join the faculty.
And your plan is to come back and join the faculty when?
In 2020, fall of 2020.
And so people will be able to sign up for your classes.
Yes, that's right.
And what are you going to be teaching?
Well, I'm having conversations about that with department chairs. I would like to do an introduction to demography, basically an undergraduate class that teaches you the fundamentals of demography. Very helpful class if you're interested in marketing or public health or lots of other areas. And then I'd like to develop a course about the 2020 census. It will have very important impacts on this country for the 10 years following the decadal census. And I'd like students to understand why that's important and why it underlies so much of our statistical system. I know that sounds a little dry and dull. I try and make it a pretty interesting class.
So looking at the list of presidents of the university, we have Alderman Library, we have Newcomb Hall, we have the Darden Business School, we have the Castine Arts Center. Do you have a secret wish where you'd like people to come to the Teresa Sullivan spot? What something you'd like to have your name attached to?
You know, I've been more interested in human capital than physical capital. I think I'd rather have a scholarship name for me.
Fair enough. Thank you so much for being my guest on the Wake Up Call and for having been a president for the past 8 years and for having been ultimately my boss and for being so accessible and approachable and for coming on. And I know you are getting over a cold, so I appreciate your time here. And it's been a privilege and a pleasure to have you as president of the university and to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Sean.
On the Wake Up Call. And I need to take a few last minutes to talk about, first of all, the man behind me, Dan Gould, who I think generally prefers to go unnoticed. But many years ago, I sat in Dan's chair as producer of the Wake Up Call when we were at a different radio station. And I know how much work it is to keep things going, to keep the buttons pushed, to remind the guests to announce the show that they're on. remind the host and to interrupt us to run our PSAs. So thank you, Dan, for always literally having my back. And I want to thank Rick Moore. I was Rick's producer on the Wake Up Call many years ago when we were at another station. The Wake Up Call has a history of going back, I think, nearly 20 years. And I used to be that guy pushing the buttons. And occasionally, Rick would put me on mic or we'd arrange for me to come in and talk to guests. And then when the Wake Up Call came to WPVC, Rick said, "Hey, you know what? I kind of liked having some occasional weekend off. Would you come in and do this?" And so for the past, lost track, but it's not quite 3 years, I've had important people like President Sullivan. As I told her before we came on air, you're actually my second college president. Frank Friedman was my guest last year. I've had city councilors. I've had the mayor. I've had important faculty members like Michael Suarez of the Rare Book School and Bob Chapel of the Drama School. But I've also had I've had a lot of friends. I've had students. Andrew Burrell was a drama student here who came in just as he was graduating to talk about his plans in the future. I've had it's given me an opportunity to sort of mesh my interest in life, which is arts and writing and theater, and have guests on who can talk about that, how to make a life in the arts. So I want to thank everybody who has been my guest here on the Wake Up Call. I want to thank the station managers at WPVC, Jeff Leonard, for bringing me on board, and Mike Friend. I want to thank the staff here for giving me the opportunity. I am taking a hiatus. My plan is to come back with a differently branded show, probably still only once a month because I'm a busy guy. So I appreciate WPVC even considering giving me that opportunity. All of our shows are available on cvalepodcast.com, and I have made it a little easy. All of my shows, both here at WPVC and the work I do for the Virginia Film Festival, can be found at cvilleradio.org. So pay attention to SeavilleRadio.org for announcements in what my future plans are here. And now I turn to my guest one last time and give you an opportunity, Teresa Sullivan. Is there something that you would like to say to our vast listening audience of tens or twenties of people?
Well, thank you for interviewing me today, Sean. You've obviously developed some good interviewing skills. I also want to thank the University of Virginia and the people of Charlottesville, because I have really very much enjoyed the opportunity to be here and to serve. And I'm looking forward to what the next chapter is going to bring.
We all are, and we're looking forward to having you back on grounds, and I'll bet your class is going to be very popular.
We'll see.
This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.